From the land-grant university in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the fifth day of August 2026. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Ed Ossett. He's an agricultural economist at the University of Minnesota. Greg Johnson is away from the office for the afternoon. We'll take a look at agrivoltaics, or the practice of intercropping with solar panels. We'll hear from Madhu Khanna, who made a presentation during a field day on the South Farms, the energy farm, in fact, right here on campus at the U of I earlier today. And then we'll turn our attention to the weather forecast. As we close out our time together, Drew Lerner from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City will join us on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online on demand at willag.org, willag.org. Where right now you can also find information today in the calendar of events about tomorrow's crop physiology field day. We hope you will join us on South First Street. All the information about the crop physiology field day is online in our calendar at willag.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
September corn for the day at $4.36¾, finished 5½ cents lower. December at $4.60, down 5½ as well. March contract $4.75¾, down 5¾. November beans $11.74¾, three lower on the afternoon. The bean meal down $2.50. The bean oil 48 cents lower. Soft red winter wheat up 4 cents at $6.61¼ in the December. The hard red December at $7.31. It finished 6½ cents higher for the day. Ed Ossett, agricultural economist at the University of Minnesota and with Extension, now joins us to take a look at the marketplace. Thanks for being with us, Ed.
Thank you for having me.
If you would you put into historical context next week's USDA crop production report? It is due out on the 12th.
A lot of people follow it. I follow it. I like to look at it nationwide, and I like to look at it for my own state of Minnesota. If I can start small, I'll tell you that the state of Minnesota is doing great. Our corn crop conditions are similar to the best years we've had over the last 40 years. When I say best, I look at years where we delivered a yield well above trend. And we've got that those type of crop conditions in Minnesota now. We got the same thing going on in soybeans, the same thing in wheat. It's possible with a nice finish that my great state of Minnesota, where we worship gophers, could deliver record yields in all three crops. Now, if you look nationwide, it is more of a mixed bag. It's always more of a mixed bag nationwide. More, I think speaking to something closer to a trend line yield. USDA's got, 183 for corn. And I hear this morning that StoneX came out at 184. And I'm not going to disagree with that sort of that zone.
That is an assessment. Farmers across Illinois, maybe the eastern Corn Belt, where yields are likely to be much more variable, or at least the crops look that way at the moment, will not accept. I'm wondering what the soybean crop might look like in your area.
Similar story there. In fact, for Minnesota itself, our soybean conditions are running better than our best years, the average of our best years. And nationwide, again, more of a mixed bag. You know, Minnesota is sort of standing out this year, and it's not going to be that good nationwide. And yet, you know, we have some really good areas going. Here a couple of, a week and a half ago, I had a chance to drive through southeastern Minnesota, going on a little bike trip with my spouse, and frankly, it was mind-blowing how good the soybeans looked that early in late July. So a mixed bag again, but I'm not going to disagree with USDA's viewpoint on an average yield.
USDA currently has the soybean yield across the nation at 153 bushels to the acre. Again, 183 for the corn. Those numbers will be updated a week from today on Wednesday the 12th. Do you think that a summer high has been achieved in soybeans?
I think that's a good guess. Now we're watching weather. August makes the soybean crop. And tomorrow I'll be at Farm Fest, and I'll take you back two decades, 2003, a year I went out to Farm Fest. And I only mention it because it's in Minnesota. It's in the first week of August, and I spoke at Farm Fest in 2003. And as I left the event, I distinctly remember that it was sort of drizzly rain. And I was ruining a nice new pair of shoes. You know, I could see the mud getting on my shoes, and it bothered me. What was interesting about that, it was the last time it rained for 5 weeks. And of course, if you look at the 2003 corn crop and soybean crop, the corn crop was fine. It was sort of a trend line yield, sort of a normal corn crop in Minnesota and nationwide. The soybean crop was not. I've had arguments with weather people. I said 2003 was a drought year. It just came 3 weeks too late to hurt the corn crop, but it hurt the soybean crop. My point is, I'm not predicting it's going to stop raining. Doesn't look like that is the prediction, but it will be driven by weather. And if we can assume a normal August, I think the highs are in.
What advice do you have related to bushels that will need to go across the scale at harvest?
We're going to be, if in fact the highs are in, if we can in fact enjoy, if you will, a normal harvest and harvest pressure, prices will be a little lower by harvest. I do see possibilities after harvest. I see big carries in the market, possibilities for people. Anyone who had the nerve to get some new crop sales done in the May bulge, in the echo that came in the last month in July, if they got some sales off with a hedge to arrive or a future sale, there's a great opportunity to roll that hedge forward, particularly in corn, from the D's to the March, the May, or the July of 2027 contract, and add more to the bottom line. That doesn't help you much at harvest. If you've got to run it across the scale, we're probably going to be disappointed at harvest. I don't think we're going to see the lows we saw in the last 2 years. That got very extremely low. That I remind people, the December contracts of the last 2 years both dipped below $4 a bushel at harvest, or I should say it by late August of each year. Here we are at 461. I'm not suggesting we're going to go under $4 a bushel this year. I don't think the fundamentals are there, but could we go another 20, 30 cents lower? Unfortunately, yes.
Hey, thank you much for taking some time with me today, Ed.
Okay, Todd, thank you.
Ed Ossett is an agricultural economist at the University of Minnesota and with Extension. This morning, I joined the AgroVoltaics Field Day on South Campus at the Energy Farm and spoke with Madhu Kanam. She's the director of the Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and Environment, or ICE, at the University of Illinois. I asked her to tell me about the SCAPES project, or Sustainability Collating Agricultural and Photovoltaic Electrical Systems, at the University of Illinois. It's funded by USDA and explores growing crops underneath or between solar panels to maximize land productivity, boost farm profits, and merge renewable energy generation within agriculture. It has been going on now for 5 years.
The SCAPES grant is now in its fifth year. We're just starting our sixth and final year of the project. And when we started the project, we actually knew very little about agrivoltaics, and even the concept itself was brand new. But since we have been doing this research. We have really learned a lot about how agrivoltaics performs under different environmental and soil conditions, with different types of crops, and with different configurations of panels. Our project has looked at three different locations in the U.S., the rain-fed state of Illinois, the semi-arid region of Colorado, and the arid region of Arizona, where different types of crops are grown. In the Midwest, it's corn and soybeans. In Colorado, it's essentially grasses. And in Arizona, it is specialty crops that require irrigation. These crops differ in the amount of shade that they need in order to be able to reach their maximum productivity. And so we have learned that really the performance of agrivoltaics and its impact on yields differs across these different cropping systems. Crops that are shade tolerant, like basil, beetroots, do very well under agrivoltaics. Other crops like soybeans and sorghum that require full sun will have a negative impact on their yield, at least under current climatic conditions. And this, of course, changes depending upon areas where we see more extreme weather and extreme precipitation. There are some benefits to being grown next to panels. So it really varies depending upon the crops and depending upon the design of the panels, the type of panels that we are using.
From the research that has been done, are there comparative advantages from one region to the other that make agrivoltaics or using a collection of sunshine along with some kind of crop or animal production more likely?
Yeah, agrivoltaics is likely to be much more, productive as a cropping system in areas that are arid, where preserving moisture is critical, and that there's a need to reduce the amount of irrigation that's required, and also where we have high value crops, so things like herbs and greens like lettuce and spinach and so on, where preserving moisture actually improves the quality and then reduces the need for irrigation, or vineyards and so on. Would be much more productive and profitable in those areas, whereas for areas that require full sun, crops that require full sun, where we need to increase the space between panels and in order to be able to move heavy equipment, it is going to be, we're going to lose both the energy yield that we can get from an acre of land as well as the yield of the crops that we're going to get per acre of land. And so that's where there's going to be greater concerns about the profitability of agrivoltaics.
What is the difference between the energy production of a solar farm compact commercial solar farm? Corn ethanol, soybeans, the regular row crop kind of production, energy coming out of those. Have you done research in that area?
Solar energy generation is very efficient as a way to generate, convert, solar radiation and generate renewable energy. It's one of the most efficient ways that we know of to be able to use solar radiation. So in order to meet our electricity needs, looking over the next few decades based on what is projected, we can meet 40% of our total electricity needs by 2040 or 2050 by converting only less than 2% of our cropland to solar energy, because it is very efficient and we need a small amount of land to generate a large amount of electricity. However, the problem is that we need to generate solar energy close to where it is being demanded. And so we may have a lot of land in the western part of the U.S., but we cannot generate all our solar energy there and ship it to the other parts. So we need to produce it in various parts, including in the Midwest and the East Coast and so on. And in many of those places, the amount of land that is currently in agriculture is already shrinking. And converting some of that land into solar panels then means that it can make those agriculture communities unviable and lead to infrastructure challenges and so on. So that's where the issues related to the concerns about taking land away from agriculture are coming up.
That is Madhu Khanna. She is the director of the Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and Environment, or IC, right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I spoke with her earlier today at the Agrivoltaics Field Day on the Energy Farm. Let's turn our attention to the growing regions across the planet and what the weather and climate has been like. Drew Lerner is here now from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Hi, Drew. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, I hope everything's going good over your way.
Kind of staying status quo at this point, and that is a phrase that I think you have been using for the weather across the planet and the growing regions. Why is that the case?
Yeah, you know, we are in a big stagnant rut here for the world, and I think it can all be attributed to the El Nino phenomenon. It is such a large event and so significant that it is controlling certainly the tropical weather, and there's an oscillation that occurs in the tropics called Madden-Julian Oscillation, and it has really put that phenomenon into what looks like an infinite loop where it does not rain well in southern parts of Indonesia, and it continues to restrict some of the rain in other tropical areas of the world. But it seems like it's having some influence on the mid-latitudes too, because we have not seen any serious deviation in any of the major mid-latitude production areas in several weeks. And it can be tied back to the start of the El Nino event. So I believe that it is having some influence in that respect. And if we start looking at some of these places, you know, China has had a very good year overall. Probably the only thing that's been threatening to China is it's been a little bit too wet in the south, but the main corn and soybean areas are getting plenty of moisture, and I don't think there's been any serious temperature anomalies that have occurred, so I think they're on the right track there to do fairly well. Some of the rice areas in the south have probably been a little bit too wet. Now, we do have a rather large typhoon that's headed for China, and that might set the apple cart here a little bit. It should come inland this weekend. It will be a large event, producing some flooding rain over a fair amount of eastern China. So that'll be something that will be watched. But really, China is in the same boat today than it was, you know, 2 or 3, 4 weeks ago. And we kind of say the same thing about India. The only thing I want to say about India, though, is that we are going to see some more traditional El Nino influence starting next Monday. And from next Monday, for the following 2 full weeks, India is going to see a below normal precipitation bias once again. And it's going to be more notable this time around. They've done really well with rainfall in recent weeks, but I think they're going to turn a corner here. It's going to get a little bit more interesting in that country.
Can you tell me a little bit more about Indonesia itself as it's related to the dryness? This is a place that produces an awful lot of palm oil, and August is a month that can drive soybean prices, particularly if there is enough dry weather in Indonesia through the fall months. What do you think of that crop?
Yeah.
Or at least the weather there.
You know, most of the short-rooted crops in Indonesia, that would be like corn and sugarcane and some rice too, for that matter, those crops are already being hurt by the below normal precipitation that has occurred for at least 2 months now. The top soil and subsoil running short to very short. But the tree crops, you know, the oil palm, the rubber, the coffee and cocoa and coconut, all those deeper rooted trees have the ability to tap into some deeper subsoil moisture. So they have not been impacted yet. But this El Nino is only 2 months old, and it's got 4 more months to go before it reaches its peak. And if it continues at the level of intensity that it's at today, which is the prediction, that we will most likely see stagnant conditions in Indonesia. And so these tree crops will eventually run low on moisture. So as you ask about the autumn season, these next 2 or 3 months, we'll see a steady decline in that deep-rooted moisture level, and crop stress will evolve. And this is one of the reasons why when El Nino occurs, oil palm is not usually impacted in the first few months, but usually something like 4 to 6, 7 months down the road, it usually has a notable decline in production, and that's the road we're on.
Okay, so now turn your attention to the growing regions in the United States. Start in the northwestern Corn Belt. There had been concern. I don't know whether that has been alleviated by the weekend rains and early rains this week and or what it might look like going forward.
Yeah, you know, the weekend rain event was certainly impressive, and so is the cool air that came in behind that. I don't know if you knew it or not, but up in part of Canada's Saskatchewan crop areas, the temperature got down to 33 degrees here a couple of mornings ago, and we saw upper 30s in northern Montana, and it's been pretty chilly. And yesterday, the highs in Nebraska were in the 60s. So that actually, that cool down has really helped a little bit for those areas that did not get good rainfall over the weekend. Now, those areas are concentrated mostly on a small pocket in southeastern South Dakota, northeastern Nebraska, northwestern Iowa, and part of southwestern Minnesota. And that area is still pretty darn dry and needs to see some significant moisture. But because it did get so cool, the crops are getting a little bit of a break. They're kind of on hold at the moment, but they still need that moisture replenishment. And we don't have high volume rain headed into that area. So it will continue to be an issue. In about 4 or 5 days, we'll start heating up again up that way. I don't expect excessive heat for another, well, probably week, week and a half. But if they don't get some significant rain in this in that time frame, we will be looking at a greater degree of stress and more pressure on some of that production. But the rest of the surrounding area did get relief, and they're doing okay today. It looks like there may be some timely showers that come on, you know, but this is summer, and it's hard to get high volume rain events to occur in that part of the world during the middle of summer. So I'm thinking we're probably going to continue to limp along. We've got a lot of August is still ahead of us. Now, it is still dry to the northwest of that in canola and wheat country in central and southwestern parts of Canada's prairies and the northwest U.S. plains, Montana, and parts of North Dakota. And all that region has not seen good rain and probably will not. And so they, like Western Europe, are probably going to continue to see a dry bias for quite a little while yet.
How about Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, and Nebraska?
Yeah, now that's a different side of the coin, and certainly I think conditions in those areas is much better. Iowa's had a number of rain events, except in the northwest, as I mentioned before. The east and south is probably doing fairly well. Illinois, I think, has had some timely rains. Wisconsin certainly has, and parts of Minnesota. As we go forward through the next 10 days to 2 weeks, we will get some timely rainfall to occur in all of that corridor and the rest of the Midwest, for that matter. So it's really down to just those few counties in the northwest there that we talked about that have the biggest issue with dryness. Now, we could get into some trouble down the road, but at the moment, I don't see it. And so I think for now, it's a good status quo environment, I believe.
On that note, thank you much. I appreciate it.
Have a good day.
Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Joined us on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It did come to you from Illinois Public Medium. It is public radio for the farming world online on demand at WILLAG.org. I'm Extensions, Todd Gleason.